This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Tech Talk with me, Angeline Tay, and it's the first time I'm doing this with Karamjit Singh and also with Anusha Kandasivam from Digital News Asia. And we also have Aaron Sarma, founder of Touristly. Welcome back to BFM Radio.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Yeah, it's been a year since the Startup Confessions, but there's another reason why you're here today.
Yeah.
That is AirAsia.
Correct. Yeah, also, because it's your first time hosting the show, we'll be polite and we're not going to ask you the difference between bit and bytes and binary code and ASIC, okay?
Thank you. Very kind of you.
Right. No problem. Because obviously, Frida knows all that like the back of her hand,
correct? Savage, yeah. Kind of savage.
No, I'm not going to ask her. So anyway, yes, Aaron, so I think you had a hugely exciting and nervous, few days, and now it's all on the up, right? Yeah. Now that you're... deal with AirAsia has been announced. Yeah. Just talk about the significance of this 11.5 million ringgit, deal, which is part, of the value of assets they're injecting, and then there's also that loan, right, that they're giving, convertible loan.
I think the premise of what we're doing. So good afternoon, everyone. It's good to be back. The premise of what we're doing was when we started the business, we realized that we were building a very niche product. We were targeting people who wanted to travel, but only for the on-ground activity component. And back then, we thought, by doing just this niche, we can plug into other guys. So guys like AHOC. In fact, on my very first deck, and I showed my angel investor, I said, hey, these are people that we could sell our business to. So... Yeah, there were three logos on it. The other two don't matter anymore. AirAsia was on the deck for sure. And so it was something that we were really keen on. And we realized that part of the challenge we'll have in the business is customer acquisition. And a lot of startups, when you raise funds, you use a huge chunk of the funds you raise to acquire customers. And so this deal with AirAsia, which took quite a while to put together, but basically was on the premise that if we could sell our products to the AirAsia base, which is huge. And last year, they served 60 million travelers. And this is going to be, and it's growing every year as they add more and more routes, as they go to more and more destinations. This is certainly something that we can be a part of. And so for us as a company, the assets that we're going to get from this will allow us to serve those 60 million customers, not just for 1 year, but for every year following this deal. Yeah. And in terms of the cash, of course, we want the cash to grow the business. And we fully believe that with the assets we'll get and the database we'll get, the business itself will be able to sustain quite comfortably. But of course, having capital to grow and to develop more things is always good.
Yeah. So you're going to be using and you can jump in, because Frida is normally quite rude and she just cuts my questions, mangles my questions up. So in terms of the funding, the money, right, that you're going to get, so that of course at some point, I guess AirAsia has the right to convert that into equity, right? Or do you also have the option of repaying that?
Without speaking too much into that, so it is a loan. So we are able, and it's a convertible loan, so we are able to pay that back. So we have quite a bit of autonomy and control over how we deal with that loan as a company. So obviously, we want to make sure we can pay it back as quickly as you can. And AirAsia actually would want us to do that, because that means that the company is way stronger in 2 years from now, or 3 years from now, or 5 years from now, versus where it is right now, because we fully utilize that database and grown the business in such a way that it's a sustainable entity.
I think Tony, if you read his the press release, right? So I didn't speak to him, but he mentioned that this is a big step for AirAsia towards becoming a digital airline. And I thought that was quite interesting, because when we had our first What's Next conference in 2015 and he was our keynote speaker, he said he announced that AirAsia is an internet company. Not AirAsia is going to be an internet company. So now, use internet company, now digital, airline. So, and you've been liaising with them. How big is this digital push, within that organization? Because obviously they see this as a very important, acquisition for them in their growth path.
Yeah, I think what I've learned from time within AirAsia, and I think what some people may not realize, is that we've already been working with AirAsia on a commercial level for some time now. So we've actually had time to work with the teams, understand some people in key management, build that good working relationship. So our tiny team of 12 people figured out how to kind of make friends in the organization and grow that relationship, right?
Yep.
So we realize it's a very progressive organization. And what people, now we look at AirAsia as a big multi-billion dollar company. But really, Tony and Dato' Kamaruddin are truly entrepreneurs. They're two guys from the music industry who had no business starting an airline, but they started an airline and the success that it is today. So what I find very interesting is that they are very progressive. They see the opportunity, and the future is in digital, and the future is in allowing them to sell more and more products to these customers that they're reaching. And so you've seen over the last couple of years, they have the in-flight Wi-Fi, which they have been working very hard on. Big duty free is also something that they are working very hard on to really help people buy duty free, and you can buy it before you even fly, so you pick it up in the plane. Okay, okay. So there's quite a number of interesting products they've already built, and we are probably the first external company coming in with a ready-built product as well. So I think AirAsia as an entity is really seeing the potential digital beyond just putting planes on the ground and landing it. It's now about giving a whole full suite solution to the customer.
And I think one of the things I mentioned in the article was that, you know, now for the first time, Tony has an opportunity to have a share of wallet of his passengers. He used the word guest, right? When they've departed, right? When they've left the plane. Mm. So you give him a chance to get that share of wallet. Now, from what I understand, and Angie, you can jump in. I think, are you itching to jump in, or are you just
scratching? No, I'm just listening.
But no, he was saying that now the fact that when the... So the way it works is that if all of us, we're about to fly AirAsia, and I think you kind of get an alert from them saying, you know, your flight is 3 days from now, and we hope you have a good trip. I guess once this deal is formalized and the legal, you know, all the dots are signed, then along with that, Aaron, is that going to be a special offer from you for saying, you know where I'm going already, right? On the ground, are you going to be able to offer something, or how is that?
Yeah, so we see the future is in really being able to personalize the content. We on our platform already, we can kind of understand the kind of traveler who's going, because we know if it's a family of four, if it's if it's two people, if it's a bunch of guys, we kind of know what you want to do, so we're able to then target customers with more relevant content, and we see that that's really the way to go forward. Right now, if you fly AirAsia, you do get an email from us, which is an email actually from our platform, promoting a couple of interesting things you may want to do in this destination. And so we're going to double down and build this technology even further, so that when you're booking a flight, when you land the confirmation page, you'll say, hey, Angelin, here's for your next trip to Bali, here are five things that will be really cool for you to do. Karam, for you and your family, here are a couple of things that may be interesting
for
you.
How deep are you going to go? Right? Are you going to say, like, hey, Angelin, you know, here's three things from Bali, you know, or will you be able to say, we recognize your last trip was on Malindo Air, you know, I'm sure you didn't have a good time.
I don't think they're able to track.
I know they can. If you're like Frida and the whole world knows wherever you are, whatever you're thinking, you know,
well,
2 seconds
later. Well,
I'm not
Frida, you know.
Okay. No, but are you then going to be able to say, okay, you offer a few things, but are you then going to be trawling, you know, using big data to say, you've obviously checked her Twitter feed and all, and you know what she likes, and say, hey, we understand you like this. Bungee jumping is an option and just been introduced. We have that package for you. Going down to that level, because to me then that's kind of creepy, coming into the creepy mode. I don't know, but if that's where you guys are going, you know, share with us.
I think that the whole internet is going in this direction.
Oh my god, the whole internet is going creepy. Okay,
you read even Facebook's talking about things like this as well.
We all feel bad already, because you have slippers following you on Facebook if you view this on, you know, an e-commerce platform.
Right.
So I think people are getting used to this creepiness.
Getting used. Okay, that's an interesting point. Do you think people are getting used to it? I've actually incidentally heard over the last week two or three people complaining about their discomfort with that, but it's not to the extent that they will now stop using Facebook. Interesting. Is this just you're resigned to accept that because likes of Facebook, not so much Twitter, right? Facebook is part of your social fabric.
More
really,
and more people
scary.
Are starting to realize that Facebook and Google and whatever are like reading their darkest, deepest thoughts, and you know, asking them things before they even thought about it themselves.
Yeah.
And coming to accept that, like you're saying, so
but
you're
people
okay
are not
that,
stopping using Facebook.
Not
and stopping. All that.
I do
definitely
think as a company, and I think we, Touristy will take this approach as well, that we should not be invasive about this and make people uncomfortable and like, you know, Karam, you went to this site, so there's this funny, interesting place that you should go to.
Oh my god, you know which sites I serve.
There you go.
You know, time to upgrade my browser security.
So in a sense that we do feel that there is a very high level, like demographic kind of information that should be enough to give you a good proposal of, you know, you're going with a family of four, so therefore you may be interested in a theme park, you may be interested in a museum, you may be interested in a zoo trip.
That's very high level. So it doesn't look like you're going to be hiring a data scientist then to go into a big data space?
I think eventually you can, but my point is that the goal is not to become a spy and really get too deep into this, but to really understand the customer without really breaking any customer comfort levels. Yeah.
But just to answer the big data question, because that's a big thing everybody's going into. Yeah. Are there plans to use some of the money to hire a data scientist?
Yeah.
You don't have one in-house yet, right?
We've got analytics people in-house, big data is a different... Yeah. But I think the thing about big data is that there needs to be data, it needs to be big. Yeah, so as we get more and more information, it makes more sense to hire somebody who can specially look at
this. But with 60 million travelers on the platform,
that's
a lot of data right there.
And like I think Aaron was saying, it's very high quality leads because they're already committed, they're spending money, they're traveling, and you know where they're going, right?
Mm. Yeah. So that's and this amazing. Is something that we saw. So before we did the commercial deal with AirAsia, and we did what every startup does, is we donate money to Facebook and Google. Buy ad space, right? And we saw a certain conversion rate, which made us very comfortable. We're quite happy with that. Mm-hmm. But then when we did the commercial with AirAsia, we saw it almost double.
Wow, the conversion.
And that really speaks to the fact that these people are on path. Mm-hmm. So they're going to go there because they've already bought their flight. Mm-hmm. The question is, are we presenting offerings that's interesting enough to the customer?
Right.
And if they are interested in what we're offering, they'll buy it.
Right.
And so that's the basic premise of what we're saying, is that, look, it's highly qualified leads. They're going to go there. And so if they don't buy something, it's either they're not there because for a holiday or whatever, or we're just not doing a good enough job.
Yeah.
So the onus is on us to really provide really interesting stuff, quality deals, great partners and merchants. Mm-hmm. And I think when we do that, customers are really happy because they know, okay, I book a flight in AirAsia, I don't have to think about my activities because they're going to recommend the best thing for me to do. Yeah.
Mm. Okay. All right.
Interesting, yeah.
So
very exciting for you, Aaron.
Thank you.
Do you want to add a question for him?
No. Yeah, I think we're just going to have to take a quick break.
Yeah. So your team is super excited about having Tony Fernandez drop by once in a while.
That's right.
And your two angel investors are able to call him bro now, right?
So there's a story, right?
Oh, okay.
The day before, I had a chat with Tony, and he said, okay, I want to come to your office, but don't you dare tell your team. I'll kill you if you tell your team. So I had to be quiet. And then because I knew it was coming first thing in the morning, and we're a startup, right? So everybody doesn't rock up at 9 o'clock as a startup. So the creator, I had to make sure that everybody was
in by
but without telling them that they had to be in for something, you know?
Uh-huh.
And then so they all start walking to the office, and then suddenly somebody calls me, Aaron, I just arrived in my Uber. Why is Tony Fernandez downstairs? And so that's why he was in the office. So it was really fun. The guys really had a good time, and he spent a good hour and a half with us. And I've been really impressed with is that he really takes the time. He's interested in knowing what we're doing. Mm. And even though he's always seen as a visionary, he can get really down in the details as well and say, hey,
that's
maybe
the accountant
in
him, right?
Okay, and also just the fact that he can see opportunities, right? And he'll say, hey, you know, maybe you should look at this as an opportunity. And we try to take that to heart as much as we can.
Fantastic, man.
We'll definitely check in on you again, you know, soon to see what you have up your sleeves, right?
Soon he'll be too big for DNA, man. I only speak to Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, Economist.
And that's Aaron Sama.
Founder
of Touristly. We also have Karamjit Singh and Anusha Kandasivam. Up next, we'll talk more about Founder Institute, ETGO, and also GoGoPrint. So stay with us. This is Tech Talk, BFM 89.9.
Broking financial mergers. BFM 89.9.
We're back on Tech Talk with Karamjit Singh and also Anusha from Digital News Asia. Just now, we spoke to Aaron Sharma about AirAsia, you know, taking 50% stake in Touristly. But now, let's move on to more interesting stories, Anusha. So we have the first one is the Founder Institute ready to kick off fifth semester.
Yeah. So Founder Institute is a global entrepreneurship program, and the Malaysian chapter is their fifth intake is in May. And actually, there's only a few more days before registration closes. It closes on April 25th.
Yeah. April 25th.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's next week.
Next week.
Tuesday or whatever.
A few more slots left, I think. Mm. So I spoke to Heislik Lo, the co-director, and he told me all about it. So it's basically a very early stage accelerator. So it's for people who have skill and experience in a specific domain and they have an idea, but they're not founders yet.
Okay.
So they want to know what to do with the idea, how they can grow it, and basically they want to learn how to become a startup.
Okay. Basically, learn how to build prototype also.
Yeah.
Also. So it's like Aaron Sharma when he had the idea, but before he, you know, let it all hang out and took the big leap, right?
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. It's a 14-week program.
1-4.
Okay. Yeah, so that's 2.5 months. Yeah.
But you know, the Hopkins will say that's not a good number, man.
14 weeks.
2.5 months.
Bosui.
So every week there's a 3-hour session with mentors, and they go through different topics with you. It's a comprehensive curriculum. So it's everything from ideation, how to do market research, finding the right team, how to get funding, and then you also have homework. So, So after the 3-hour session, you have to go and do things like, you know, go out to your target market and ask them, do research, ask questions, things like that.
Three-hour session? position, you said, huh?
Poor
class. Okay.
Yeah. So I was told by Heislik that it's a very strenuous program, very intensive, because you have homework besides the three-hour session, and there's actually a 70% dropout rate.
Wow, are you serious? 70%?
Yes, 70%.
Wow, this is serious stuff, huh? Which is good, right? You want to get serious about this?
Yeah. It's a global statistic. It's the same program everywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. And
Same. Okay.
Yeah, exactly the same. So everybody in the world is going through the same thing that you're going through. And he says it's that intensive because creating a business is hard.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you want to simulate that in the real world. Mm. So you got to go through all this so you know exactly what you're getting yourself into.
Mm. Yeah. And also, I guess the reason why that's dropout rate is when you go in, you realize this is not what you want to do. And
yeah,
also,
maybe.
I guess, and they have mentors in there to sort of validate your idea and say, okay, you know, maybe you have too big of an ideal, but this is not practical enough.
Yes, yes. Mm. So a lot of people, either they figure out that really the idea is kind of weak and is not going to go anywhere, or they just can't take it. They can't take the stress and the challenges of it. It's not the right time for them.
Yeah.
So maybe they got to come back another time and do it. Mm. Yeah.
Actually, there's no right time, I think, you know. So it's kind of interesting. You could do a whole series on when's the right time, and there's no right time.
Really tough.
It's all up to you, basically, whether you're ready to take
or how crazy you are, and just forget it. I'm going to do it.
Whether you're obsessed or frustrated about something, right?
Yeah.
So there's to get in, there's a test that you do. So so
aptitude test or what?
Yes, an aptitude test. It's a proprietary test of Founders Institute. They kind of created it themselves. It's a psychometric test. It's data-driven. So they've got data from all over the world. So it's got a lot of data. And they kind of test your general attitude, your drive to succeed, your open-mindedness, which is very important because you have to be open-minded enough to change your idea or change your plan, you know, things like that. And if you can't do that, then definitely you're going to drop out of this
program.
Interesting. Yeah, sorry.
I'm just saying that it breaks your founder's ego, right?
Yeah. If you have, I don't know any founders who got ego, maybe Anthony Tan after you raise, bucket loads of money. No, but interesting. I just had an EDM, electronic direct mail, from the World Islamic Economic Forum. I don't know how I got on their database, but one of the headlines caught me, and asking these entrepreneurs about their experience. And one of the lessons learned, and one of them said that, you know, they said your management team has to have IQ, and then you as the leader, you have to have, your leaders have to have EQ. But they say founders need to have AQ, adversity quotient, because you're gonna go through so much adversity, right? So do you have, like Patrick Groff will use grit, right, and perseverance. So interesting is he used the word cure, you know, the quotient thing and the adversity quotient. I've never seen that before. It's
That's
a nice way of coining the experience because, and I use the word pain, right, how high is your tolerance for pain? Because you're going to go through, like I said, the journey is so hard. That's why Founders Institute program is difficult. You want to just weed out people before they jump in. Mm. So
this program takes place in Penang.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
Heislik told me there's huge potential for entrepreneurial talent there, definitely, and there's a huge demand for accelerator programs. There's a lot in KL, but there's not as much in Penang, not enough. Yeah, so they moved this there last year, so this is the second year that they're going to be in Penang. Registration closes on April 25th,
which is Tuesday, I think.
Next Tuesday. Okay, so put in your calendar if you want to join this Idea Stage Accelerator.
See if you're tough enough to get through all this.
Okay, and now moving on to the story on Eatigo launching in Malaysia.
Yeah, so
another food. What is this, a restaurant booking or food delivery?
It's not food delivery. It's a restaurant reservation platform.
Okay.
So you make your bookings.
It's like Benson Chang, right? Running
Table App? Wow. Actually, Table App is kind of more traditional because they just allow you to make reservations.
Okay.
Eatigo specifically allows you to make reservations on off-peak times.
Off-peak. Hey, that's
off-peak.
Off-peak. The Ban, his name also keeps
Banyu. Banyu.
Banyu, yeah. They're doing quite well too.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I spoke to Michael Kluzel, the CEO and co-founder, and he actually told me very clearly off-peak is a clone of...
Really? Banyu. Okay, man.
Are you listening?
So
he was like, Eatigo is the global first mover in this
global first mover?
Yes, they are the first, yeah.
Okay.
Where was it formed then? Where did it start?
They started
from?
In Thailand.
Thailand, huh? And it's a global first. Wow.
Yeah, they started in Thailand. They were in Bangkok, Pattaya, and Singapore first. Mm-hmm. And then they just moved to KL they officially launched yesterday, but they've been around for like 2 weeks.
Okay.
Wow. And then they're also in Hong Kong for a few weeks. They've been there. Yeah. So they got funding from TripAdvisor, their Series B.
Last year. Did they share the amount?
No. Series A plus Series B is US $15.5 million.
Combined.
They wouldn't tell how much.
That's a lot of Thai baht right there, man.
But basically, they said their Series B is being used to expand into other markets.
Mm-hmm.
So they have very clear scopes. For Series A, they wanted to prove the viability and sustainability of the business, to show that it would work in Thailand and Singapore. And Series B was to prove that not only is it sustainable, but it's exportable to other markets.
Mm.
And they want to reach meaningful revenue and break even quickly. And so he told me that they want to be number one or two in the market by the end of the year and break even within 2 years.
Wow.
Number one or number two. Who's number one then, if he says that they want to be number one? Who does he see as number one? Did you ask that?
I did. He didn't tell me, but I suppose it's probably one of those people. But but in other areas and all the other countries they're in, they are number one.
Oh, they are?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So if he said that it would be quite easy for them to reach that level.
Interesting.
Yeah, I guess we just have to wait and see, right? Itigo versus Off-Peak.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. There you go, man.
Yeah. What they do is... this is how he explained it to me. So for restaurants, they generally have two... busy times, lunch and dinner.
Correct.
In between, the tables are empty, but your fixed cost is still running.
Absolutely.
So it's very inefficient. He says that the global sit-down restaurant market is $2.6
trillion. Mm-hmm.
Right. But this is at 35% efficiency.
Usage, okay.
Yeah, 35% capacity utilization.
Okay. Wow.
So if they can improve this by another 10%, that's $260 billion market for
coming
them.
Yeah.
So what Itigo does is 90% of its users, it drives traffic to merchants' restaurants during off-peak hours, and they guarantee these restaurants additional profitability during these times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he said this before to many, lots of people, that Itigo is the anti-Groupon.
Mm.
Yeah. Because Groupon basically drives traffic to you, but during peak times, and then you kind of lose profit because you're catering to people who are there for discounts.
Yes.
Whereas Itigo does totally the opposite thing. They do give users like huge discounts, but they drive traffic to you when you are not getting any traffic at all.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just the off-peak, model. So it's not rocket science. I think for startups to claim that somebody has copied them or what, it's a waste of time, because now you just light a fire under your competitors, right? And everybody copies each other, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's really about execution. But they've raised a lot of money. Like I said, that's a lot of butt, and you convert that, 18 million, was it, US, you said, combined?
15.5.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. So I don't know. I forgot how much your off-peak raised, but, them and even Benson.
Mm.
Although Benson, you said, does it just straight off? He hasn't evolved the model. He hasn't evolved his model to add this to try to cater for this.
No.
Interesting.
I don't think they want to, because it's very successful business model, this.
Benson,
actually.
You mean?
No, I'm talking about Itigo.
Oh, Itigo.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, were you talking about Benson?
Yeah, because I said Benson should evolve his model. Instead of just providing reservations, then try to fill the pain point that restaurants have, right, where you no butt sitting in your...
There are a lot of models, right? So it's either you bring people to your outlet on off-peak hours, or now also there's a lot of people coming up with pre-ordering. So you go there, you just eat, so you don't have to waste time with waiter, waitresses, because that's always the issue, right? Labor also is an issue.
Yeah.
So we just probably wait and see who comes up with that idea and able to expand
it. The multi-billion, since the market size is so big.
Yeah, it's huge.
Mm.
He did mention that for users, they have to kind of change human behavior, which is very difficult.
Yeah, of course.
Because Southeast Asian people are not very big on making reservations, especially in Thailand, he said. People just hate making reservations. They just don't do it. It's not part of the culture. Mm. It's a bit more here
just
in Malaysia.
Just live for the moment, spontaneous. Yeah.
YOLO.
Yeah, but in Southeast Asia, people have this really great discount affinity. They love discounts and deals. So
who don't?
Yeah.
Who doesn't?
So people actually use the app not to make reservations, but to get the discount. months. And you can get up to 50% discount every day on in every restaurant is on the app. Yeah.
Okay. All right. After this music, we actually go into a story on Gogo Print disrupting the Southeast Asia's printing industry.
I hope it's a Bhangra song, man.
Sorry, it's not. It's Listen to the Music by Doobie Brothers. So Tech Talk with Karam Singh, Karamjit and Anusha. Tech Talk, BFM 89.9.
Bulletins for managers. BFM 89.9.
We're back on Tech Talk with Anusha and Karamjit from Digital News Asia. So now let's head straight into Gogo Print, ready to disrupt the Southeast Asia's printing industry.
Yep. So Gogo Print is an online printing startup. And we all know that printing industry is on a decline. But the online printing industry is booming everywhere in the world. So what Gogo Print has a very unique revenue model. They do not own any of their own printing facilities. So what they do is they work with traditional printers. They buy capacities from them. It's much more efficient. So what they do is they have a software and they use an algorithm to aggregate orders.
Mm.
Yeah. So it reduces costs and costs can be shared among all the customers.
Yeah.
So okay, so this is how he explained it to me. I spoke to Laurent De Candido, the co-founder and managing director of Gogo Print Malaysia. So he says traditional printers, generally, they won't switch on their machine for less than 500 copies of the flyer that you want to print. But if you're a small company, you don't need 500 copies. Maybe you want 50 or 20.
Yeah.
So you can't use them. So what they do is they aggregate orders from all kinds of people. So if some people want 100, some people want 20 copies, some people want 5. They use the algorithm to... it's called ganging. They put all of these orders onto one giant sheet of paper and you can print it all at once. Yeah, so that's how the costs are shared between all the customers. And it's being quite successful among the target audience is SMEs. So they're doing quite well there. They launched in Malaysia last year, November. So they are the ones who claim that they are disrupting the Southeast Asian printing industry. So I asked them how, and they said basically that's how they're fulfilling volumes of orders that traditional printers just can't do.
Won't accept. Okay.
Yeah. They do have some big corporate clients, but most of their clients are SMEs, and they're mostly B2B. They do have a few individual customers, like people who like order their wedding cards or business cards, things like that.
Small scale
stuff. But most people order brochures, flyers, you know, things like that, like little files and things,
magazines, right? You want to get something done. A lot of people self-print books also. I know I was in a friend's place many years ago, and I think a family member who was like one of the pioneers in the trees, to do with trees, not farming. What do you call it?
What do you mean?
Like FEMA? No, no.
Plantation?
No, the one in Kapong. What is it called?
That
forest reserve in Frim. So I think he had a family member who was one of the pioneers in Frim. So forestry, right? Yeah. In the forestry, you know, ecosystem in Malaysia. And then they actually then wrote, the family wrote a book about him, and they just self-printed it. So, wow, it's like a 90-page, right? And a memoir, and to keep, you know, the person's contributions going for memorial. And memoriam, I thought, wow, fantastic. Yeah. So, stuff like this.
I don't think they do books or magazines, but they do those kind of things that SMEs need, which are flyers, brochures, cards,
is more regular,
you know, vouchers, things like that, now, because they don't own any printing facilities, they're relying on third parties for their products, for services. Yep. So the challenge is quality control. Laurent told me that they keep a very close eye on quality because quality is essential for repeat business, and that's what they need, repeat business. And they have growth is a very big goal for them. Obviously, they're very new, so they're not profitable yet. And he wouldn't tell me when they want to break even or anything.
Those are the questions we have to ask, right?
Yeah.
It's for them to say, I decline to share that with you.
But they're very, very focused on constantly bringing in new products and new services to drive growth. And I don't know if you guys have ever heard of Printi, which is a Brazilian-based online printing company. They have the same investment company as Gogo Print.
Okay.
It's called... Online Printing Group is a global investment company. And Online Printing Group also invested in Printi. And Printi is about 5 years old. And they're huge now. They have about 200 staff. They're market leaders in Brazil. And so Gogo Print is kind of trying to emulate that in Southeast
Asia.
Oh,
I can see Printy saying, hey, they copied us.
Yeah, right. Well, they have the same investor. Yeah. So they're kind of trying to go that way and make, he told me they're trying to make the same right decisions that Printy is doing. Yeah.
Okay. Mm. All right. So moving on, the action goes back to you, Karam.
Okay.
You have a couple of stories to share with us as well.
I think the one I like is by a listed company, End-to-End. So, you know, we started the show with a listed company, AirAsia, acquiring a stake in an internet company, and because they see the company helping them move their model further up, right, and get, like I said, share of the customer's wallet. This is also an acquisition, but this is a full acquisition in all cash. And this acquisition has allowed the entrepreneur, after 17 years of aspiring to claim something, to be able to claim it.
Okay.
So the entrepreneur is Andrew Tiang, and he's the managing director and co-founder of End-to-End Connect. End-to-End is actually one of the largest, and all the brokers out there, people in the financial industry, will know about End-to-End. They are Malaysia's largest provider of online real-time trading platforms, right, for capital markets. Mm. And he says with this $11.5 million acquisition, all cash, of this Hong Kong-based financial data and trading solutions company called AFE, okay, I obviously don't know who they are, but Andrew knows. He's in the same space. But these guys, AFE, deal in financial data, whereas End-to-End, you know, does a lot of the trading platforms.
Yeah.
So now, but you know, you've like your Bloomberg terminal, right? You can do trading on that.
Mm-hmm.
But Bloomberg terminal is also attractive because lots of information content on it, right? And this AFE provides financial data and trading solutions. And
right.
They've got some patents also, according to Andrew, around that space. So makes sense for him to acquire. And this company has been around for like 30 years, man.
Gee. Yeah, but they don't serve only the Malaysian market,
no,
right?
No, this company serves North Asia. So that's why it's complementary. Like Andrew serves
Kong.
A few Middle East markets. Hong Kong, they both overlap. But Andrew wasn't really in Hong Kong. So these guys are based in Hong Kong. I think they've got 60 headcount there.
Gee.
And then they're obviously in Japan. And although Andrew is in Japan too, because he had a Japanese company, Quick, invest in them. I think they are one of the largest online trading trading platform in Japan that Japanese brokers use. So that's his Andrew's Japanese connection, and now he's acquired into this company. And he said after 17 years, you know, he said when they launched the company in year 2000, we aspired to become Asia's largest one-stop service provider in the financial industry.
Mm.
And now with this acquisition, it helps us fulfill that mission. So he's hugely excited.
Yeah.
And about the upside too, because they can upsell now to those customers, you know. You're mostly, customers AFE are mostly using content by buying their trading services. Hey, you know, you can use our platform and start trading too.
Yeah.
And then vice versa, now AFE can use, we offer you a trading platform.
Mm.
So Andrew's very exciting. And he says that actually because of what happened now, because they're combining both segments, it's very appealing for clients for both sides. And he says that both their trading install base and terminal install base will increase by 200% each on a consolidated basis after the acquisition is done.
Wow.
So that's a really win-win situation, right?
How did he get the figures, though?
I think because he looks at, good question. So I didn't ask him that. When he said 200%, you mean you're just doubling it, right?
Yeah.
Because now you're, the amount of customers Andrew will have who are buying, you know, just information will double because they've got AFE customers coming under his umbrella.
Yeah.
AFE will say now we've got so many more customers that we can now say are selling our trading platform, which is offered by Andrew's End-to-End.
Mm.
So that's why then he says on a consolidated basis, both are doubling, you know, their install base and terminal base. So trading base and terminal base. Very interesting.
Yeah, it is.
Upsell. And you know, he said they're now the largest customer for Thomson Reuters too.
Okay.
They're actually the largest single customer in Asia. And that volume then gives you a lot of advantages too, right?
Mm. So they actually give data to this kind of agencies as well.
Correct, yeah. Okay. People buy information, they want to know news, right?
Mm.
So very interesting. And I think he's looking forward to end-to-end growing even further. So just both examples of listed companies, right, making acquisitions.
Yeah.
So kind of interesting.
Yeah. And then there's also on eSIM. Sorry, on eSIM? Telco contracts and
roaming
charges.
So that was just because I think a few years ago, I don't know, last year actually, I met with Sigve Brekke from Telenor. He's the, you know, president and group CEO. And he was saying that SIMless, you know, when SIMless comes to mobile phones, that's going to be a game changer for telcos because then you don't own the customer. Because your phone, when you get your phone right now, you got to go to a telco. You actually physically got to go and you got to get the SIM card, that magical SIM card. And when you're to change telcos, although it's very easy with mobile number portability, you keep your number. You got to physically go and cancel your subscription and then go to another telco. Now with this, the number is because the SIM is in the phone itself, right?
And in the phone, yeah, the in hardware the phone, or yeah, the software?
No, in hardware. The
in
phone.
The hardware, okay.
Yeah, so it comes with its own SIM, and then you got to now, you control your destiny, right? You're allocated a number, and that's yours, and you can decide to choose. And then is at some point, you will even be able, as you move around in your day-to-day, your phone will just automatically then be able to pick up who offers you the cheapest rates for making calls from this area, and you pay them. So billing is going to come down to that micro, you know, a per-call basis too, and telcos are just going to fight like crazy to win the customer.
Because
because I don't think many customers have brand loyalty with their telcos. So with this eSIM coming, you know, it's a very, very exciting and different ballgame. It's probably almost, it's a cliche, but it's probably almost the worst nightmare for telcos, you know.
They have to evolve, right?
Evolve, yeah. So Sigway, I mean, Telenor Group is already aware. All of them are aware, right? Nobody's going to be caught by surprise. How do you then become really, really close to your customer that they want to stick with you?
Yeah.
Exciting times.
When will it be here, though?
Well, this French company, Gemalto, which offers it, is already in the market now. And I think some companies will start using it. It depends on how I not so much visibility into this, but this is an area I'm very interested in. So I'm going to read up some more and meet some people and talk about it. Maybe in our telco deep dive in June.
Yeah.
It's definitely an important story that we want to bring, you know, users up to date with. And they're finally free from the... from that, you know, lock-in period, right?
The tyranny
contract,
of the telco.
The tyranny of the contract.
Okay, we're going to go for a short break, but when we come back, we'll end with some reading list by Karamjit. So today we have Karamjit Singh and Anusha Kandasivam from Digital News Asia. Stay with us, BFM 89.9.
Build financial mountains. BFM 89.9.
And we're back on Tech Talk with Anusha and also Karamjit. So this is the last part of the show, and we have a reading list.
Yeah. So one is a company out of Indonesia, because we obviously got staff there and they write about the local ecosystem. And this is called Coinworks, and they are a peer-to-peer online lending platform, and they try to raise money for SMEs.
Mm.
Yep. So you as an investor, you go in with as little as $7.5. You invest that, and you can your money, which is about 100,000 rupiah. Then your money, this Coinworks will use your money and lend it to SMEs.
Okay.
So it benefits the SMEs because they then pay less interest, and it's not so intimidating for them than instead of going to a bank. And these guys obviously do due diligence. But my point of sharing this is that read the article, because just, you know, in all countries, everybody's trying to solve pain points using the internet as a platform, right?
Yeah.
To lower the cost. So that's kind of interesting. And, you know, they've already had 2 billion rupiah invested in them by investors. Not like a VC coming in, but just average people, you know, whoever giving them money and say, use my money and loan it out. Because there's also a social cost, right? You know, help your SMEs get access to funding. Mm. Then, of course, you make a good amount of return on that also.
Yeah.
And which 20 billion rupiah, by the way,
20
before I get excited, it's only $1.5 million.
But it's still a lot of money,
yeah,
right?
In the local ecosystem, it is.
I guess they call it also microfinancing in a way.
Yeah. So this is, but I think this is not microfinancing, because they use each SME, I think a maximum that an SME can, that they will rent, give out to you is, the amount is somewhere here, if I can find it. It's 500 million rupiah per SME.
That's how.
So it's not really micro. Yeah, I don't know. It's like maybe in the tens of thousands, right? Or 70,000 ringgit. But they give them, and they have had hundreds of SMEs which have reached that maximum. So for those SMEs, very easy way for them to get 500 million rupiah. And then, of course, then the next stage, you've got to go into the formal banking system. That's kind of an interesting story. So read about that.
Okay. And then that's Coinworks, K-O-I-N works. And then there's also one reading list on MDEC.
MDEC, yeah. So MDEC, this is interesting. They've introduced the Malaysia Digital Hub, which is partnering with 3 co-working spaces for entrepreneurs to have come there. And like what Anusha said, a mixture of maybe help with them in growing their business, a quasi-accelerator, although workspaces don't offer you that, but they have access to people who can help you with that.
Yes.
And then I think MDEC is driving this. And then they've also launched the Malaysian Technology Entrepreneur, if I get the thing wrong,
M-T-E-P.
The acronym. Yeah, Malaysia Tech Entrepreneur Program.
Mm.
And this is also to help entrepreneurs from around the world to say, hey, come and build your business, tech business from out of Malaysia. And there's some benefits there. I looked at it at a high level, and it didn't look very interesting, didn't look very thought out yet. And if you go to the mtep.my website also, it doesn't really spell out the value in a strong, concrete manner. And one of the things they offer you is that you have access to funding. People have access to funding anyway. Access to funding means I'll introduce you to a VC, and then if they shut the door on you, sorry, I've done my job, right?
Yeah.
If you want to bring people from around the world in, I think you actually got to put money on the table. Say people who get in under this program will have this pool of money that, you know, will be allocated to the best among you, right? Mm-hmm. Not every one of you. Mm-hmm. So value proposition doesn't look strong to me right now. Mm-hmm. So
who are they targeting? So tech startups, anyone?
Tech startups and even established companies from around the world anywhere. Okay. So they just, it's an attempt to make Malaysia a more vibrant, you know, tech ecosystem.
But the whole hub, e-hub that you know, in conjunction with Alibaba is trying to launch here as well.
They already launched, so it's happening. So all these just activities just to move the digital economy further. But this one is, I think, needs to be drilled down further, and I think they can do a better job in selling this. Yeah, but that's, you can read about that.
And I think the final list.
So last week, coincidentally, in our Digirati 50, we ran a story because it goes by alphabetical. It's actually Tony Fernandez, so you can read about him. And then this coming week, which is on Saturday, we're gonna share our story on Viren Doshi from Catch That Bus. So if you like to take bus journeys, you know, you can read a little bit about Viren's journey, in our Digirati 50 profile.
Digirati 50 profile.
So that's coming on Saturday.
And everything is available on the platform,
right? Yes, on the platform. DNA. As long as we keep paying our host, it's available on the platform.
And that's Karamjit Singh and Anusha Kandasivan from Digital News Asia. Do check out their stories online. And you've been listening to Tech Talk on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.